On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. We're talking about public access to records and the state of open government in Wisconsin. There was a newly released 10-state compliance audit of freedom of information laws, and it ranked Wisconsin among the top five. But last year, the Wisconsin Transparency Project sued Governor Evers on behalf of a Milwaukee TV station over his reluctance to release emails under the state's open records law. So how do you think lawmakers should maintain records of their work? Should they be allowed to delete emails? Do you think they should be allowed to delete scheduled meetings on their calendar? You can join the conversation. We're at 800-642-1234. Amanda St. Hilaire is an investigative reporter for WITI Fox 6 News in Milwaukee, and she's part of a team of reporters who produce a podcast. It's called Open Record. It takes viewers behind the scenes of stories. Amanda, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
So now, the end of last year, your station sued Governor Evers over his office refusing to release copies of emails. Before we get to the lawsuit, can you explain what emails you were seeking?
Sure. So this really was an open records spot check. And we do spot checks on open records pretty frequently because we want to see what's there, if there's anything we're missing. So I had done a spot check for 2 weeks' worth of emails on more than 50 state lawmakers a few months prior. We thought, okay, it's time for the governor's turn as well as his cabinet. So we originally requested roughly 4 weeks' worth of emails, and it wasn't any particular time period. We just picked four random weeks, and that request was denied. And then we narrowed that down because we thought, okay, maybe there are a lot of emails here. We want to be able to work with any public agency if they're going to have trouble getting the records that we request. So we narrowed the request. That was denied. And then we kept narrowing it. And finally, we got down to 1 day's worth of emails. And it was a random day within that original 4 week period. And even that was denied. And that's when we said, okay, there's an issue here that maybe needs more exploring.
Yeah, so, you know, 1 day, you know, 1 week, 1 day, 1 hour. What was the governor's office, what was their rationale for withholding the emails?
Well, originally, after I had filed the request, I had a phone call with the governor's staff, and it sounded like the initial concern was that there were a lot of emails here to go through. But it became pretty clear to me that no matter how narrow of a time frame I requested, it was going to be denied if I did not have essentially search terms or words that could be turned into search terms.
Oh, so like the word budget or agriculture.
Budget, exactly. And it sounds like maybe not a big deal at first, but as we talked to open records experts, we found out, hey, this is kind of a big deal because when you have to limit your searches to specific terms or phrases, there's a lot that you could be missing. You don't know what you don't know, right? So if you have to limit that, then we could get to a place where these records that are supposed to be public, it's now very easy to keep them secret. And we had a problem with that, hence the lawsuit.
We're discussing how state lawmakers, the governor, other authorities handle records of their work. We're with investigative reporter Amanda St. Hilaire from Fox News in Milwaukee. How should lawmakers maintain records of their work? Should they be allowed to delete emails or scheduled meetings on their calendar? Should anyone from the public be able to get copies of lawmakers' email correspondence? Join in with your thoughts, your questions, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So, Amanda, what did advocates for transparency in government, what did they tell you about the back and forth between you and the governor's office?
Well, you know, it's bad when even the lawyers say there's too much lawyerization, right? So we spoke with April Barker, who is an open records attorney, and she has represented an agency that sued Governor Walker's administration in the past over email. So she has quite a bit of experience with this. We spoke with Bill Leaders, who is president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council and has his own experience with open records lawsuits. And they both said the same thing. They said that they're concerned that this basically gives every other public agency permission to make it harder for people to get public records. And especially when it comes to emails, that matters because these are the records that show you how the people who represent you, how the people you elect, how the people you pay are making decisions, who's influencing them, what goes into that process. And if we can't see it, and we're certainly not saying in this case that we suspected any corruption, but when we're unable to see it, that's when people start having questions about what the process is, and that's when you can open things up to potential corruption should you have someone who wants to take advantage of that system.
So how did your station decide to sue for the release of the emails, and what is the status of the lawsuit?
Yeah, the lawsuit was a last resort. It's not something we like to do. We cover the news. We don't want to be the news. But the way Wisconsin law is set up, when you get to a point where an agency is downright refusing to give you records, a lawsuit is really one of your only options. You can petition the Attorney General's office to see if they'll bring an action, but in this case, the Attorney General's office represents the governor, so that's not really an option. So in order to get the records, we had to file the lawsuit. So after trying to work with the governor's office for several months, that was the option we were left with. At this point, the governor's office has filed an answer to our lawsuit, and now it's going back and forth and submitting evidence and letting a judge decide.
So the office did, though, release some of the emails you had wanted. What did you learn from those new records?
Yeah, so the way this unfolded was after we had gone back and forth with Governor Evers' staff, we decided, okay, we're at least going to do a story about this. We asked them for comment. They never gave us a comment. So we showed up at a Governor Evers press conference and asked him directly. And he said he had no problem with his emails being released. He said, in fact, they'd be pretty boring because he hardly uses email. So literally 10 minutes after we told the governor's office we filed a lawsuit, they did release one day's worth of his emails. And in that sense, the governor was right. They were pretty boring. There were some press releases, discussion about logistics with different events, the governor's travel schedule. But the point isn't necessarily how boring or exciting the records are. It's the fact that we were able to get them and the fact that we had to file a lawsuit in order to get even the one day. Now, we still haven't received the other records that we had requested. So the original 4 weeks, the 2 weeks we had narrowed it down to, the 1 week. But the idea is they're still holding on to that idea that they can selectively withhold these records. So in their response, the governor's office said, hey, we're going to give you this one day's worth of emails as an exception, but just so you know, we don't think we actually need to release any of this in the future, and we still think that we can withhold this at any time. And so the principle of what we're fighting for still very much stands.
We're talking with WITI-TV investigative journalist Amanda St. Hilaire. We're looking at government transparency and access to public records. What type of information do you think the public should be able to know about its elected leaders? Have you ever filed a formal request under Wisconsin's open records law? Did you get the records you were seeking? How did your agency respond to you? Join in at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. There's more State Cap in just a moment with Amanda St. Hilaire right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're looking at the state of open records laws in Wisconsin ahead of Sunshine Week next week. That's a national observance of open government. Governor Evers was criticized last year by Open Records advocates for initially rejecting a reporter's request because it wasn't limited to a specific subject or a specific word. Should anyone from the public be able to get copies of emails sent to lawmakers or sent by lawmakers? How much do you want to know about who lawmakers are meeting with and how they're going about their day, their business on email? Join in 800-642-1234. We have investigative journalist Amanda St. Hilaire from Fox 6 News, and she goes after these records and she stays with us. So we had a caller who couldn't stay with us but wanted to know, if Amanda, if you've done an open records request for former Governor Walker's office, and what was their transparency like in comparison to the Evers administration?
Sure. So I started working in Wisconsin at the end of Governor Walker's tenure, so I personally don't have a direct connection with his emails. I can tell you that transparency experts tell me they don't see a significant difference between Governor Evers and Governor Walker's when it comes to transparency with public records. Governor Walker himself was criticized and was sued over access to public records and specifically access to emails, although it was a slightly different issue. So that seems to be the general consensus. I have spoken with Evers supporters who say they're disappointed that they don't see a significant departure from Governor Walker in that sense, but from what I gather, there doesn't seem to be a huge difference between the two when it comes to public records.
I want to take a moment and talk about private email addresses, your Gmail addresses.
Mm-hmm.
8 years ago, when I was a journalist in Louisiana, the Associated Press had revealed through a public records request that the then governor, Governor Jindal, his top administrators were using their Gmail addresses to talk with each other about their PR strategy involving big cuts to Medicaid services, $500 million in cuts. Are you concerned about the practice of government officials using personal email accounts?
It's an interesting issue because, according to the law, even if it's on your Gmail account or even if they're text messages on a personal number, if they're about government business, they're supposed to be public. And that's great in theory, but in practice, it's really hard to have oversight over how someone uses their Gmail or their personal phone when they're using it to conduct government business. So you have to essentially rely on their word that they did a thorough search of those accounts and they're actually turning over those records. Again, not saying anyone would lie about that, but my job as a journalist is to be skeptical of that. And so when we had done a spot check on state lawmakers here in Wisconsin, we did find that there were some, and it was an equal amount of Democrats and Republicans, who were using their private Gmail accounts, their Yahoo accounts, in order to talk about sometimes sensitive constituent information. Now, in that case, it didn't seem to be they were exclusively using these accounts. They were still using their state government emails a fair amount, but government transparency advocates did raise concerns that that could make it harder potentially for requesters to get those records. And again, that matters because these are the receipts. These are what tell you how your tax dollars are being used and how people make decisions. So even if you've never filed a public records request in your life, the fact that someone like a journalist can do that and sort through the records and tell you what's going on is huge, especially when it comes to accountability. And when that effort is blocked, that should be raising a red flag.
Let's bring in another call now. Chris is joining us from Toma this morning. Hi, Chris.
Hello. My comment is I have mixed feelings about it because email can be so easily misinterpreted. If you don't get everybody's email that's involved, if you don't get the full conversation, if you don't know the information. And so I feel like sometimes media is just too dang nosy, and they want to cause problems, and that's not all of them. But we hear more negative things than we do anymore than positive. So the misinterpretation from emails, I think sometimes it's too much.
Chris, thank you for that sentiment. Amanda, you know, these emails from one person don't tell the whole story. And Chris is saying you really need to have more sense of what is happening around the email.
And I think that's an interesting point, because that's exactly why we're suing the governor's office. So if you're limited to getting emails just with one phrase or one search term, then Chris is right. You don't have the whole picture. That's why we wanted the whole body of emails sent from that account and received by that account from a given period of time, because then you do have the big picture. I am going to push back on the idea that sometimes the media and journalists are too nosy, because quite frankly, it's our job to find out what's going on and tell people about it. And in order to get context, that's why we always call the people and reach out to the people we're doing a story about, so they have an opportunity to weigh in and give that context. But our job is to find information and deliver it to you, and then you get to decide how you feel about it. But you can't make a decision if you don't know what's there in the first place. And that's why we fight so hard for these records. But her point is exactly why we need to have that whole body of emails or text messages or whatever communication we're talking about, because that's where you get the context and that's where you see what's really going on.
We're talking with investigative reporter Amanda St. Hilaire from WITI-TV, and there's still time for you. What type of information do you think the public should be able to know about its elected leaders? Have you ever filed a formal request under Wisconsin's open records law? Did you get the records you were seeking? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's talk about the word or. There's this word in state law at the heart of this dispute, or in the phrase subject matter or length of time. Amanda, why is that word a sticking point here?
Yeah, and again, this goes back to the idea that you know it's bad when the lawyers say there's too much lawyering. So the law, and I'm not a legal expert here, but the law essentially says that you need to have a request that's reasonably specific to, and the phrase is subject matter or length of time. And the idea is that these agencies that you're filing requests to, they need to know what you're looking for. If they have to guess or go on a wild goose chase, that's not a great use of government time. So in our reading of it, subject matter or length of time, thinking, okay, you need either a subject matter or a length of time. In this case, the governor's office was arguing that you need subject matter and length of time. And they're claiming that by not providing search terms, we were not providing subject matter. Our argument is that we provided exactly how much information they need in order to know what we were requesting. Clearly, they knew exactly what we were requesting because they were able to turn over one day's worth of emails. So it's interesting when you're quibbling over the difference between and the word or, but when it comes to these legal issues, sometimes that's what it comes down to.
So let's look at calendars here for just a moment. Unlike state lawmakers, the governor can't selectively delete emails and meeting calendars. Why can lawmakers delete their emails or calendars?
So that was one of the first public record stories I did in Wisconsin. At least more than 40 years ago, state lawmakers wrote themselves an exception to the law. So under record retention rules, they basically said that they can delete their public records at any time, really without any notice, unless you've already filed an open records request for that record. Then they can't delete it after you file that. That matters because, one, they're not following the same rules that they wrote for everyone else, right? Your other public agencies, your city engineer can't just go through and delete his emails or delete his calendars, yet somehow state lawmakers can do that. It makes it hard to see what they're doing when they are supposed to be acting on your behalf. And when we went through and kind of tested that loophole, that's when we found out that Scott Fitzgerald deletes his calendar daily. And there were a couple other lawmakers who admitted to certain things being deleted. But the concerning thing is that there was no way for us to tell exactly how much had been deleted or when it was deleted or how long anyone held on to it. The governor's office is not subject to that same exception. So the governor's office needs to hold on to emails and calendars for a given period of time. What concerned us when we were denied emails and told that we need to provide search terms is that an attorney for the Department of Veterans Affairs said that theoretically that same idea down the road could apply to calendars. So instead of getting someone's whole calendar and seeing really where they're going, who they're meeting with, again, what's influencing their decisions, now suddenly you have to search by a certain name or know that they were at a certain meeting. And so Department of Veterans Affairs said, we give you the calendar as a courtesy, but yeah, we could theoretically ask you to provide search terms for that too. That's concerning because you don't know what you don't know.
Well, Amanda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Amanda St. Hilaire is an investigative reporter for WITI Fox 6 News in Milwaukee. Coming up, how are Wisconsin health officials responding to coronavirus? We get an update on the state's preparations with an official from the Department of Health Services. The State Capitol Report continues right after this news update here on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin health officials have asked people who travel to countries with widespread COVID-19 to self-quarantine for 14 days. At least 22 patients in the U.S. have died from COVID-19, and at least 545 people have been treated for the virus at last check this morning. Are you worried about the coronavirus epidemic and want to know what precautions you should take? What do you think of Wisconsin's response so far? What do you want to know about how the state is preparing? We're at 800-642-1234. Tom Haupt is Influenza Surveillance Coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, Division of Public Health. Tom, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks, Kate. I appreciate the invitation to talk to your listeners.
So we've seen California, we've seen Florida, Maryland, other states calling a state of emergency. Last week, your health department officials said that step wasn't warranted, not needed. Why do you not think so?
Well, at this point, we only have the one confirmed case. We have increased our testing capabilities significantly over the past week and a half to 2 weeks, and we'll continue to increase our testing capabilities now that several commercial labs are coming online as well. But again, because we only have the one confirmed case, we feel confident that it does not need a state of emergency at this point, but that could change very quickly, and we're prepared to make that change should it become necessary.
And certainly hospital workers would be on the front lines of responding to an outbreak. How is the state health department checking in with them, checking on whether everyone has the supplies they need?
Yes, we actually are doing a daily survey with hospitals to try to find out what their needs might be, where the shortages might be. As you know, people are starting to hoard a lot of the face masks and gloves, that type of thing. We really want them to leave them for the healthcare workers who really need them, who, like you said, are on the front lines of preventing coronavirus.
Do the state's hospitals have enough beds and respirators and face masks and all the other equipment that we can't even think of? Is that on hand right now, or is there extra ordering? What is the status?
Well, at this point, we feel we have enough of the ventilators and the supplies. But again, that's why we have to keep up with the with our providers on a daily basis. They need to tell us what the situation is, what the needs are. We're trying to work very hard to get their needs should they become short, whether it's personal protective equipment, ventilators, whatever the case may be. There's surge capacity plans going out, which we used in 2009 influenza pandemic. So we feel very confident in what we're doing right now, but part of the whole situation is to really reach out to our partners on a daily basis and find out what their needs are and have them communicate back to us.
Well, let's bring in a call. Peter in Viroqua. Good morning, Peter.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm wondering if there's a state policy that's been communicated to the county health department in regards to, you know, if a family has been like in Italy and they're coming back, and will their children be in school right away?
That's a real good question, Peter. Thanks for asking that. And we have policies in place that if we find out about someone who has come back from Italy, they are put on a 14-day quarantine, which means their children should not be going to school. It's a self-imposed quarantine, but where we had the situation with the people coming back from China, we actually got formal notices. So we don't always get that when people are coming back from Italy. So we depend on people to really reach out to us as well, and they've been very good about this, and understanding that we have a need for the quarantine, and they've been very compliant. But it's a very good question.
So, Tom, when you when you look at the supply situation and you compare it with 2009 following the H1N1 outbreak, in retrospect, did declaring that emergency prove to be helpful? And what comparisons, what lessons learned did you have from the H1N1 outbreak?
Absolutely. I mean, we did learn an awful lot. Even though it was considered a relatively mild pandemic, it was still a pandemic in 2009. Many after-action reports to try to figure out what went right, what went wrong, and we're using that to modify our policies with the coronavirus. So we're, again, one of the things that we really want to do is keep reaching out to our providers to find out what the needs are. We need them to come back and talk to us. We need to open those lines of communication even more than what we already have.
We're reviewing Wisconsin's preparations for an outbreak of COVID-19 with an official from the state health department. Tom Haupt is with us, the agency's influenza surveillance coordinator. Gathering your questions for him, do you know someone who has had COVID-19? How have they dealt with it? How has your family dealt with it? Are you worried about misinformation about the virus? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So the president signed this $8 billion package on Friday by Congress to address COVID-19. Tom, how could more federal dollars help Wisconsin's preparations?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're very appreciative of getting that money from the federal government. That money can be used for personnel. We're in, trying to bring people on board as we speak to help out should this become a state of emergency. So that can help out with personnel costs. It can also help out with purchasing further personal protective equipment should that be needed. The final decision as to how to use that money is through the Department of Health Services, and they're working probably on a daily basis to get some kind of a plan together as to how to use this money wisely and efficiently.
How much does our state response to COVID-19 rely on the success of what's happening at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention or other federal health authorities?
Absolutely. I mean, the CDC is the one who starts off with the recommendations, and we need to follow their recommendations as closely as we possibly can. We don't want people coming up with our own policies and procedures. We've seen that in the past where people have gone out on their own and really have made the situation much worse, where the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing. So we are following very closely the recommendations from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. There are conference calls almost daily going on, you know, between the states and the Centers for Disease Control. Yes, they're very important in our response.
Herbie from Cambria called in, couldn't stay with us. Herbie understands there is no vaccine yet. And so what does treatment look like for the patients who have COVID-19 right now? What is the treatment protocol?
Really, there is no treatment at this point. There are some experimental drugs that they're working on to see if it's going to be effective against the COVID-19. And as Herbie mentioned, we don't have a vaccine, but the vaccine itself is progressing very well, and they're hoping to get into clinical trials in April or May, which, when you think about it, is really quite impressive. How many other diseases do we have that have gone many, many years without a vaccine? HIV, for an example, when it was discovered back in the 1970s, still does not have a vaccine. So there is definite work going, and it is looking very optimistic that there may be a vaccine perhaps by the end of the year, but we'll just have to wait and see. Again, the vaccines have to go through safety trials. They have to go through effectiveness trials, but we are optimistic.
Tom, explain for us what the symptoms look like and when someone should seek help and how they should do it.
Well, the symptoms are very similar to most respiratory viruses. It can be very mild, which could be cough, congestion, mild fever. But many of the cases that you hear about with COVID-19 are the severe cases, which hit the people who are most susceptible, and that would be people who are older, the very young, and people who have underlying illness, whether it's due to medical conditions or medications that they might be on. That can actually lead to pneumonia and, unfortunately, as you mentioned, numerous deaths due to the COVID-19. People need to, if they feel that they have underlying illnesses, regardless if it's COVID-19 or not, then they come down with a fever, congestion, they need to contact a provider because there are many, many other viruses, including influenza, that are going around at very high rates at this time.
Let's take another call. Russ in Stoughton. Good morning, Russ.
Good morning. I would like to know if Tom has had any contact with Vice President Mike Pence, who's been appointed as the country's coordinator to get the virus under control. You know, is he reaching out to people in Tom's position or what?
Russ, thanks. And Tom, you know, you've had those conference calls with the CDC. What other federal connections are there?
The Department of Health Services out of Washington is also very involved with this as well. And no, I have not had personal contact with Vice President Pence, but I have had a lot of contact with the people at CDC. They call them the patient under investigation clinicians, and those have been my main contacts. But it's basically Vice President Pence, Department of Health Services, FDA is involved, CDC, all coordinated through Washington.
Going back to 2009 again, some Wisconsin schools were closed during the H1N1 outbreak. What did health officials learn about whether those closures were a good step?
I believe that if they were done for long periods of time, it did affect the transmission of the disease. We have several studies going on, even locally in Wisconsin, where we're looking to see if spring break can stop transmission, if there's a long weekend for whatever reason, whether it's a school meetings day or whatever, that if that can break transmission. And it's been optimistic that that could actually break the transmission. But what we do depend on is when people are asked to not go to schools and public gatherings, that they really comply with our recommendations, because we don't want them going out, spreading it to other people in things like a movie theater or concerts, that type of thing. So we really want them to comply with our recommendations as much as we can, but the separation can actually have a big effect.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that spring break might be that pause that would help here, but wouldn't people be going off in all sorts of different directions over spring break?
Absolutely, and that's another possibility that we have to think about, too. It might break transmission within a local jurisdiction, but if people are traveling while they're sick, and many times during spring break, plans are made many months beforehand, so they can't really stop, they can't really make those last-minute changes. Traveling sick, and this is where we're asking people to use common sense and work with us. If they have to travel and they are coughing, sneezing, they can wear a mask. It's not the problem. But just to wear a mask throughout the entire day is not something that we recommend. But your point is very well taken. It could actually cause worse problems in other jurisdictions, but it may actually stop some transmissions locally.
Tom Haupt is with us, influenza surveillance coordinator for the State Health Department, taking your questions about COVID-19, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Health leaders coordinating Wisconsin's reaction to COVID-19 say that the risk of infection remains low in our state. Only one person in Wisconsin has tested positive, and they have since recovered. Meanwhile, Milwaukee health officials say it's not if, but when the Milwaukee Health Department expects a COVID-19 outbreak in the city, but how many people the virus will affect or when it will arrive is unknown. Do you know someone who has COVID-19? How have they dealt with it? What do you want to know about how it's spread? Join in 800-642-1234. Tom Haupt is the influenza surveillance coordinator for the State Health Department, and he stays with us. Let's go to another call now. Mike is with us from Madison. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hello, yes. I've been seeing on the news where different countries are out spraying for the virus and they're wiping down surfaces in schools and so forth. But to me, my understanding was viruses don't last but a few hours or maybe a day outside of a host. Is there something special about this particular virus that it has a longer resiliency? I would think just staying out of the area for a day would pretty much eradicate the virus.
That's a really good question, Mike. Thanks for bringing that up. The COVID-19 virus in and of itself is very susceptible to common disinfectants used around and on everyday use. It's called an envelope virus, and what that means is the disinfectants can actually penetrate the virus itself and kill the virus. So it's not a very hardy type of virus, and the spraying that you see on TV, I don't know that that's necessary. That might be just an overreaction, but what we want people to do is just practice good hygiene and clean up behind themselves and really do a good job with the personal hygiene, coughing into your sleeve. That's how the virus is spread. It's very similar to almost all the other respiratory viruses. Nothing different with this particular virus.
We saw that the English Soccer League recently announced that its soccer players and referees will stop shaking hands during games to prevent the spread. Could we get to a point where people need to stop shaking hands?
It's a possibility. That has been brought up, especially in church services. And I know just meeting some people over the past few weeks, we did elbow bumps, which, was strange. But again, it's something that we don't recommend at this point. If you do happen to shake hands, I mean, you always have the sanitizers. The hand sanitizers are very effective against this particular virus. But it might be something that we see more and more of as people get more and more concerned.
Well, Mike, thanks for the call. Let's go to another Mike now. Mike in Green Bay is with us. Hi there.
Hello. Hey, I appreciate all the knowledge you're giving us. So I have a question. When you go to an emergency room in a hospital and you think you have the COVID-19, how long does it take to get the results on your test back?
Well, it's going to be much quicker now that we have the commercial labs coming on board. The test itself is only like 3 to 4 hours. But one of the issues that we've run into with some difficulty in the past few weeks is getting that particular specimen to the state laboratory hygiene, which up until this week was the only laboratory in the state that could do it. So it's a matter of getting, once it gets down to a particular lab, the test itself is very quick, usually 3 to 4 hours. We have a goal at the state laboratory of hygiene of a 1 to 2 day turnaround time, and that would include transport of the specimens to the lab.
We're discussing Wisconsin's preparations for the COVID-19 with Tom Haupt, the agency's influenza surveillance coordinator. You can join in with your questions. What do you want to know about how COVID-19 is spread? Are you concerned about COVID-19 and want to know about precautions your family should take? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tom, let's look at the individual level. What steps can a family take today to better prepare themselves for a potential outbreak in Wisconsin?
Well, what we've been telling people is we don't want people to start, hoarding face masks, that type of thing. But for any kind of emergency, whether it's a natural disaster, a snowstorm, a tornado, which unfortunately hit down in Nashville, people should be prepared and have at least some water, extra water, and extra food on hand. In our particular house, we have several large buckets of water to flush the toilets. We have at least a couple of gallons of water to get us through, drinking water-wise. But people really have to stop and think, the best thing and the best way to prevent COVID-19 is through good hygiene. Respecting other people. Again, if you have to cough, use that good hygiene cough etiquette. Cough into your sleeve. If you sneeze, get into a tissue, throw it away and wash your hands right away. But as far as really cohorting things at this particular time and stocking up, that's not something we recommend at this point, other than for what you typically would have to deal with. And as I mentioned, that could be natural disasters, anything like that. Thinking again what happened in Nashville and what a tragedy that was, people need to be prepared that these things can happen very quickly.
How much are state health officials guiding state companies and businesses facing decisions like limiting business travel or working from home?
Well, we're trying to work with them and answer their questions as much as possible. One problem that we have run into a bit in the last few weeks is our bosses are requiring that in order to come back to work that they have to be tested for COVID-19 and test negative. But we don't test people who are not symptomatic. So we're working very closely to try to get that information across to make sure that they are aware that asymptomatic people are very low risk of spreading this particular disease. We're there to answer their questions, and there has been some guidance, again, from CDC for businesses to put out, and we want to be sure that they are know where to find these as well on our internet site and on the CDC's internet site.
Well, let's bring in Sherry now in Madison. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. Hey, I was watching TV yesterday, and the head of the NIH said that the virus lives on surfaces 7 to 9 days. Unless it's eradicated with bleach or something. So I wanted to say that. And then also that I wondered, like, how quickly this virus is changing, because that was also something you mentioned, that it is changing more quickly than other flu viruses. So mm-hmm. I'm thinking it could come back around and around and around if it's changing and be just a little bit different version very quickly.
Sherry, thanks. Tom?
Yeah, very good points. With every virus, there's a potential of mutations and changing, and that's why the CDC, the National Institute of Health, the World Health Organization are gathering these viruses to see if there's any particular change, to see if they could live on the environment for longer periods of time. I will caution that depending on who you talk to, some people think that the virus does stay on for, as Sherry mentioned, for days. Others feel that it's very susceptible. We do know at this particular point that the virus can be killed with just everyday disinfectants. But yes, any type of virus, especially influenza viruses and the coronaviruses, can change. And that's part of the actual surveillance system that we're working nationally and worldwide to determine.
Sherry, thanks for the call. Tom, state health officials were briefed, you briefed state lawmakers last week on COVID-19. How could lawmakers possibly get involved in the state's response at this point, depending how the outbreak shakes out?
Well, there's always that possibility of asking for more funding, you know, locally, that we may not be able to get from the federal government. But so far, it looks very promising that we're going to get a lot of reimbursement from the federal government. But we want them to be very aware and to also help get the message out to their constituents, too. Many people are calling their congressmen and assemblymen, asking what they're doing. And the more we educate them and send a consistent message, the better off we all would be. And so far, again, we've had very good cooperation with the state government.
Well, Tom, before we have to let you go, let's take a moment to discuss nursing homes. Severe symptoms are reportedly more common in the elderly populations. What is being done to make sure that nursing home long-term care facilities are ready for this?
We actually this week are planning to get a very informative message out to all long-term care facilities in the state, again, reiterating the guidance that we have said that's come from CDC. The question has come in, do they have to screen people when visitors coming in? Do they have to take their temperatures? And it hasn't got to that point yet. But we are telling people they can put signs on the door that says, please, if you have any kind of symptoms and you have to come into the nursing home, make sure you talk to the nurses first, put on a mask, or if you can perhaps avoid any kind of contact, that would be even better at this point. But we are realizing that it is a very serious situation. It's just a tragedy what happened out in Kirkland, Washington, with all those deaths at the nursing home. And somebody came into the facility who was sick and obviously didn't practice good precautions. And that's the message that we're trying to get across.
Tom, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Yeah, Tom Haupt, Influenza Surveillance Coordinator for the State Health Department. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.